After telling his allies, including the UK, that he didn't need us, the US president called for help to open up the Strait of Hormuz, which is raised in the sharpest terms, not just the question of should we, but could we? When it comes to big military operations, what has the UK got? In this dangerous 21st century, what do we need? And can we get it? And what about closer cooperation with other European countries? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, I'm joined by General Sir Richard Barons, who's Senior Consulting Fellow with the International Security Programme at Chatham House and co-author of the most recent Strategic Defence Review commissioned by the government. Richard Barons, what's happened to the size of the British Armed Forces since the end of the Cold War?
When the Cold War ended in 1990, nobody in the UK could point to the sort of existential threat that was going to justify retaining the sort of large armed forces nearly already all the time that you needed during the Cold War. So over the succeeding 35 years or so, the army has, broadly speaking, halved in size from around 150,000 and 73,000 reserves to today about 70,000 regulars and a reserve of only 23,000. The Air Force in 1990 had 850 combat jets, and today it's got 160, though we need to recognise they're much better than the Cold War era ones. And the Navy had 50 major surface combatant ships, destroyers and frigates and things in 1989, and now it's got 13, and it can't even get all 13 to sea at once. The conundrum that we live with today, and it is profoundly important, is we've now entered a very new era in global affairs of much greater risk, but we're entering it with the armed forces we were left with for a much more comfortable, peaceful time.
Let's look at now, or the circumstances within which you began your strategic defence review. What kind of operations is the UK militarily capable of undertaking now?
So the armed forces that we have now, because of their size, but also because of their sophistication, can make a very small contribution on land, in the air and at sea to an enterprise that's either led by the US or more likely a NATO undertaking. What it cannot do is anything substantial on its own.
What is it that we can offer in an alliance, and what is it that, if we had to, we could actually achieve on our own?
So it's important to recognise that the UK has made commitments to NATO, which NATO expects the UK to fulfil. And for the Royal Navy, they do two big things. They provide the independent strategic nuclear deterrent, 20% of the UK defence budget. And their main commitment is in the North Atlantic. It's called the North Atlantic Bastion, where their job is to control that sea from intrusion by Russian submarines, ships and aircraft. And that takes up pretty much all the Royal Navy's capability in rotation. The Army is committed to NATO as a strategic reserve corps. This is a force of somewhere between 30 and 50,000 strong, so a corps headquarters and two divisions that could go anywhere in NATO where there was a need to reinforce deterrence or to recover from, say, a Russian territorial incursion. But the Army has not got the equipment or the training or the support to get anywhere close to delivering that yet. So today's army, frankly, could do one very small thing. Essentially, it could seize a small market town on a good day. And the Air Force, which has very good aircraft, makes a contribution to the NATO air and space effort. But we are talking about using, generally speaking, no more than about 20 combat aircraft from the pool of around 160.
Has it always been the case, even since the end of the Cold War, that we plan to have this little capacity? Or has that essentially come about not so much by accident, but by attrition?
So if you take the Type 45 destroyer as a very good example, in 2000, the Royal Navy successfully made the case that it must have 12 of these air defence ships. They are extremely capable at shooting down aircraft and missiles, including now ballistic missiles. And then for financial reasons, a few years later, it was 8 became affordable. And then in the end, 6 were bought and 6 exist, of which, given the financial pressures, the Royal Navy currently has 3 of the 6 in the Menders in refit, and will struggle to find the people and the spares and the equipment and the training to get two of those remaining three available for operations at any one time. Three would be a major ask. So that's three air defence ships.
Which brings us to your strategic defence review. Now, let's talk about what you actually recommended.
The defence review was built around three big ideas. The first is, look, we live in this really much harder world of state-level confrontation and potentially conflict. And this is a very different world where the United Kingdom's security, prosperity and values could be in jeopardy. And that jeopardy will come both below the threshold of military conflict, so that's cyber, social media manipulation, sanctions, cable cutting at sea, that kind of thing, and above the line in the way that if you're a citizen of Kyiv in Ukraine, you are now well aware of what war in the 21st century really feels like. So that set a new bar. The second big idea was, yes, but we have the armed forces that we gave ourselves as a result of the post-Cold War era, so there's bound to be a gap. And then the third big idea is, yes, but closing the gap is about war in the 21st century in the digital age. And for the armed forces, we argue this is the most profound change of how you build and operate armed forces for 150 years.
What does that actually mean?
There are two bits to the architecture of this new order that matter. The first is armed forces will be built around what in the defense review is called a digital targeting web. But most people call it a digital kill web, which is no more complicated than collecting together all forms of sensors, so things that see and view and listen to your operating environment, whether they're owned by the military or available on the internet or whatever. All of those sensors, wherever around the world, are networked into a common database. And the key thing here is that digital kill web architecture, where something is sensed, is then interpreted by AI in the database, operating on the database, and then instructions are sent to a weapon system to fire. That happens at a speed that was not possible without artificial intelligence. So in Gaza, from sensing to something firing, 7 seconds. In Ukraine, averagely 2 minutes. And what we're seeing play out in Iran now is the combination of the US and Israel, using their two sovereign systems in this way, can manage 1,000 targets a day, whereas before it might have been 100. So that's the kill web architecture. And then just as important, those sensors and those effectors and weapon systems, which were once the iconic ships, tanks, aircraft people think of as their Navy, Army, Air Force, they're evolving very rapidly into a mix of some platforms still with people on them, but increasingly uncrewed things like drones, mostly now increasingly autonomous weapon systems. And those are the Shahid drones with a range of 1,500 kilometers that will make their way to their target. Those are the cruise missiles and ballistic missiles that are launched, can maneuver in flight, and will then identify their target as they approach them.
Are these systems necessarily very expensive?
Well, the good news is really no. Because if you have an autonomous weapons platform, well, first of all, it doesn't need to be paid and it definitely doesn't have a pension, but you still need people and you still have to manage the evolution of these technologies over time. So they will be sustainably cheaper in the future, but getting there from a really low base is going to cost more money now.
General Sir Richard Barons. Now I'm joined by Dr. Jack Watling, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, who has a new book out this month called Statecraft, The New Rules of Power in a Divided World. Shashank Joshi, who's Defence Editor at The Economist, and Ruth Harris, Executive Director for National Security and Data Science at RAND Europe. Jack Watling, as we've heard, we've had this long post-Cold War period where the armed forces have contracted in size and now the threat levels appear much higher. So what's your assessment of the current climate within which we have to operate?
Well, internationally, we are now in a world where two members of the United Nations Security Council, the US and Russia, have engaged in offensive warfare. And if we look more broadly, there are more countries that, without contravening any international taboos, now feel that they can solve their policy differences through the application of violence, without necessarily bringing about a coalesced response from the international community. And so we are in a world where there are likely to be more wars, they are likely to be more state-on-state wars. And when we look at the Indo-Pacific and the growing tensions between the US and China, there is a latent risk of global confrontation or conflagration. And so that is a very dangerous security environment, one in which we may need to be able to use our own armed forces if we end up in a conflict. But also having strong armed forces is an important element of deterring or persuading other countries not to use such measures against you.
Ruth Harris, how do you think the climate's changed?
I think it's hugely challenging. It's very easy to sit back and think something like a strategic defence review should be written. It's fairly straightforward. What do we think Britain's place is in the world? What can we do? But when that picture is changing all the time, that becomes challenging. We buy kit and equipment to do one thing, and the next moment we're doing another. It's very easy, I think, to get caught up in big platforms and capability. But the people behind it is what drives it. Now, I take the point mentioned in the interview about drones. And it's easy to think that that's fine. There's no one flying it. That's not a problem. But the tail is really long behind it in terms of the intelligence that things pick up, how you use that, how you feed that, how you understand it. But also, who's looking after it? Who's making sure that these drones are cutting edge all the time, which they have to be, which we've seen the Ukrainians manage very well.
Shashank Joshi, you too heard the interview with General Sir Richard Barons. Do you think he's being too pessimistic?
I think he's got it exactly right, David. I think you'd struggle to find a single really informed senior general or admiral who would take issue with any of that and the huge task ahead of British defence. And I think, in fact, those in defence are probably the first to recognise these shortfalls, not least because you've got many people who began their career, perhaps in the 80s at this point, mid-80s or a bit later, who recall a time when the British Army, for example, did practice crossing rivers in really demanding scenarios. You've got people who remember when the Royal Air Force could muster much, much bigger operations on a larger scale, who can remember when the Navy could send out far more attack submarines at sea and bring them close to Soviet waters in really punchy, dangerous missions. And some of that, of course, goes on now. I'm not playing that down. But those people, I think, would recognise the vast changes and diminution that's occurred in the course of their careers.
Just so we can be clear about something, because some of the older listeners will be very used to the idea that whenever you get a strategic defence review, all the wings of the armed forces immediately say, we need this, we need this, we need this, and we need this. So what you're saying is, never mind all that. Actually, this time they're right.
They are right. Of course, they have very different visions on how to fix it. And if you speak to those from different services, you will hear a view that says perhaps Britain can't do everything it wants as it has done in the past. It needs to choose. It needs to focus, for example, says one view, on air and maritime capabilities on the flanks of NATO in the high north, in the Mediterranean, and leave the land warfare on a large scale to countries like Poland and Germany. Others will say no, you know, that's abrogating our NATO commitments to produce two divisions to meet our commitments for a strategic reserve core capability for the alliance, and you need to build up those land forces at the same time. So there are still enormous differences among insiders on the sort of force they want to see, but I think none of them would fundamentally disagree that things are in a pretty woeful state at present.
Jack, talking about that woeful state, Richard Barons had that very telling image of struggling to take a small market town on a good day. Allowing maybe for the imagery, is that broadly how you see it?
If we look at what it takes to take a single village in Ukraine, so facing the Russians and therefore a highly capable adversary in terms of the armaments they bring to bear, the Ukrainians trying to defend Bakhmut lost 10,000 people, killed and wounded, over the course of the defense of Bakhmut, which is a small market town. And that would almost be the entire infantry force of the British military. So, yes, General Barons is right. And it's important to note that the demand from NATO, which we signed up to, and the Foreign Office and Number 10 signed that commitment, requires substantially more capability.
Richard Barons mentioned reservists. Could we look at that for a moment?
Yes, it's been a challenge, definitely across all three of the armed forces. The acknowledgement that we need reservists is there, but we don't really understand how to go about it. The length of time, even if someone expresses interest, to actually bringing that person to bear, or even signing them up, can be up to a year. They bring skills and expertise that sometimes we don't have in the armed forces, things that they're learning outside high-tech environments, and we desperately need them.
Shashank, are we in Britain part of the majority of European countries who don't have national service, or do the majority of European countries actually have some form of national service?
A lot of the most large and influential countries either have a form of national service or are reinstating it, as you see in countries like Germany and France, where they've been absent for a long time and are realising they need to bring this back and are doing so.
From what you hear and what you know, do you think there's the remotest possibility that a British government would consider a national service system in Britain?
I think it's politically toxic, and I think that it's something that would be very difficult to achieve, not least because you also need a big upfront investment in training, housing, equipping the forces that you are bringing in.
Jack Watling, can we look at equipment now for a moment? What do we currently have available to give them to fight with?
One of the challenges that we've had is that as a result of the armed forces declining after the Cold War, we had relatively large stockpiles or fleets of vehicles and equipment. So when it comes to the Navy, for example, we have deferred retiring ships and delayed buying new ones. And because we had quite a few escorts previously, we could essentially just keep putting them to sea. But of course, you hit a point where they break and there are not the spare parts, and now you don't have replacements. And so all of a sudden, a very small proportion of the fleet can actually do anything. The absolute numbers don't tell the story here because the usable numbers are declining all the time. If we think about Challengers, we have quite a few Challenger tanks in the British Army still, but we have sent a huge proportion of the spare parts to Ukraine to service the very small number of Challengers that the Ukrainians have been using that we gave to them. When we think about artillery, we gave Ukraine most of our howitzers. We only have 14 now in the British Army.
1-4.
1-4. Now, just to support a division, you should have 72. And we have committed to NATO that we should provide a corps, which is 3 divisions worth of artillery.
You do the maths here. 3 times 72 is what you should have.
Yes, for the commitment we've made. And
which is over 210. I can work that one out.
We have 14.
And we have 14.
And more importantly, we haven't invested in the production capacity to provide the munitions that they would need. So those 14 would run out of ammunition rather quickly. So it's about the logistics, the spares, the industrial base, the things that sit behind the platforms.
Ruth, of course, even if you were to have all the money necessary to do all those things, they would take some time to do. But let's talk about whether we will or would have the money.
So at the moment, we're on about 2.4% of GDP, with a push going towards 2.5% by 2027, and then going to 3% by 2030. Now, you'll have heard the Prime Minister at the Munich Security Conference hint that that 3% would be met within this parliamentary term. But there's nothing tangible about that right now. In the plan, the big money comes after 2030. So the money we're getting right now simply plugs the gaps. It starts to make the capability, kit and capability that Jack's really clearly run us through, become serviceable, restock the supply chains, get the ammo, the weapons back in place slowly. The thing to remember on all that, though, is we're not the only people doing that. There's competition across Europe and now from the Middle East, US and Israel in order to restock, in order to address issues of supply chains. So that becomes increasingly challenging. So ultimately, sometimes it won't just be about the money, it'll be about the availability.
Shashank Joshi, does all this complexity explain why the government seems to have delayed its financial response to the Strategic Defence Review? I should say that we asked the Ministry of Defence about that, and it said it's still going to be forthcoming, but we were expecting it in the autumn.
Yes, I think forthcoming is doing a lot of work there, David. This is the defence investment plan or the DIP, we've been waiting for it for a very long time. And fundamentally, the problem is a lot of the money that's been promised is not really turning up until the very end of this decade and then the 2030s. And the real issue with the DIP is how do you fit together all of the existing commitments and make them all work? So, for example, how do you get the money for AUKUS, which is the Next Generation Attack Submarine program with Australia and the United States, for GCAP, which is the program to build a sixth-generation fighter jet with the Italians and the Japanese, and then at the same time recapitalize the army so it can take more than a market town, as Richard colourfully put it, and build out the aircraft carrier strike group so that it has the air assets, the air wing that it needs, the protection that it needs. Basically, you cannot do all of that on the current fiscal trajectory. And therefore, that difficulty in making a choice, and it's a very political choice, it's not a choice the military can make by itself, is what I think has large part has delayed this very basic document that should be translating the defence review into reality.
Ruth, is it really as simple as we're going to have to cut pensions if we're going to afford the armed forces that we think we need?
I mean, yes, it does come down to that. There are trade-offs needed. We can always jump on pensions, social care, welfare issues, potholes, all the rest of it. But yes, it comes down to that. You cannot have everything. Now, we can be clever about it. We can drive a hard bargain when it comes to what we pay and also decide how we buy stuff, where we buy it from. Are we buying it commercial off the shelf? Are we buying it from the US? Are we buying from the US and then waiting while we grow our own business, our own industry more than we already have? Now, we have a great defence industry in the United Kingdom, and we should be very proud of it. But we don't have a relationship between government and industry and the armed forces that allows us to maximise this.
Can we get into the business a little bit more about the technology which may or may not become available? Richard Barons was also talking there about the sheer capacity that modern warfare has for targeting, for being able to hit so many targets simultaneously, versus the question of just how many people you need to do it. Jack?
You still need a lot of people.
As Ruth, what Ruth called the tail.
You need people to maintain the systems, to launch them, to prepare them. And actually, there are a lot of jobs that you can't automate in this space. You definitely can't automate judgment when it comes to moral and political decisions. So there is a requirement to retain a significant number of people. And in terms of the technology, we can get infatuated with technology. The reality is that it doesn't matter whether it's a very sophisticated drone or a very dumb shell, you still need explosives, which means that you need the capacity to produce explosives. And you need propellant charges. You know, where do we get the cotton for our propellant charges from? We mainly get it from Kazakhstan, if we can, or from China. And we certainly don't have the ability to enrich it with nitrocellulose and turn it into propellant powder in this country. So the lack of that supply chain means that we can have the greatest targeting web in the world, and there's nothing that's going to go bang at the other end.
Richard Barons mentioned that people in Kyiv are discovering what modern warfare looks like. And one of the ways in which they are is all these drones and missiles which are slamming into their cities. Do we have any defence capacity against such an attack?
We have very, very little capacity for air defence. No capacity to defeat ballistic missiles. We have a handful of air defence launchers that could defeat cruise missiles. We would be largely dependent on the Royal Air Force getting on top of them and shooting them down. But there are quite a few countries between us and Russia, and there's a lot of sea space if they come around from the north. And one of the things about the commitments that we make to the alliance and to our allies is that that buys us a huge amount of protection, a belt of protection, where actually those countries have invested quite a lot in air defence.
Can we just look at a doomsday scenario? What if the United States does effectively walk away from NATO? What if what is left of NATO is essentially the European powers plus one or two other powers? What would we have? Jack?
Too few munitions and limited intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance capacity. A lot of the technological advantages that we use to defeat our adversaries or overcome our adversaries are space-based, and they depend on huge amounts of US investment in space-based collection, reconnaissance, and then all that processing that happens with the data when it comes back. And in addition, just look at how many missiles and bombs the US has been firing in its campaign in Iran. In Europe, we do have the design for these systems. We produce very, very good weapons, whether it be Storm Shadow, as the Ukrainians have shown its effectiveness, or Meteor as an air-to-air missile, and so on. But we're not investing in the production volume necessary to be able to capitalize upon those advantages. And that's why it's very important that we make sure our Air Force has enough missiles and bombs. We make sure the Army has enough ammunition.
It's one thing the US walking away, and it is possible, but we have to ask the question, would they still sell us arms and munitions? And I would say the answer to that is yes.
Shashank.
There's another problem here, which is that whilst you can purchase munitions subject to availability, subject to the US needing them elsewhere, what is much harder to purchase in that sense is intelligence. And if you think about what we get from the United States, particularly in the UK, not just Europe, but the UK particularly, it is battlefield intelligence.
One of the things, again, that Richard Barron said is Europe is actually a wealthy continent, and it has a lot of money, and it has the capacity if it works together. Is it realistic to think about creating a genuinely integrated European pillar of defence with integrated command and so on, which might be able to operate either within NATO or, if necessary, independent of it? Shashank, what do you think?
If you're thinking about this as Europeans asking, what do we do without America? I think in that doomsday scenario, assuming that the US is not actively sitting inside NATO, preventing the alliance from being used because it does rely on consensus, there is more sense in trying to inherit and assume responsibility for existing NATO command and control, which is both a headquarters, but also literally physical communications, physical buildings, than it does to try to start something from scratch, which would be immensely difficult. And of course, would also unleash a really toxic and difficult debate about who would lead this European force.
I'm going to ask just one last question. I just want you all to imagine that I'm the Defence Secretary and I meet you in a lift and I say, look, I can't do all the things that everybody's asking me to do. But if I could just do one thing now, what would you advise it to be, Ruth?
If it was only one thing, it would be the air defence of the United Kingdom. Because if we are weak ourselves, we don't help anybody.
Jack?
Invest in the capacity to suppress and destroy enemy air defences.
So that's one, our air defences. The other one is taking out their air defences. Shashank?
It's very unoriginal, David, but bring forward spending so that more of it comes before 2030 in a period of really heightened danger and less of it after 2030. And that will lubricate and open up some of the funds necessary to do what Ruth and Jack both want to do.
And that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Jack Watling, Shashank Joshi, Ruth Harris and Richard Barons. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirsty Knight and Nathan Gower. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineers were James Beard and Neil Churchill. And the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Jamie Bartlett, and for BBC Radio 4, I'll be looking at how fakery took over the world.
No, hang on, sorry.
You're not Jamie Bartlett, I'm Jamie Bartlett.
Oh, really? Well, who am I then?
I'm afraid you're not real, pal. You're just an imitation chatbot I created to help me make this series on modern fakery and why it's everywhere.
Sounds good. What's going to be in it?
Well, there's a lot. 1980s professional wrestling, dodgy academics, AI psychosis, COVID vaccine skeptics.
What's it called?
Everything is fake and nobody cares. With me, Jamie Bartlett.
And me, Jimmy Bartlett.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.